You are listening to From the Sea, a podcast series produced by South China Sea Studies. This program provides valuable insights from experts around the world on geopolitical and security developments with regards to the South China Sea as an area in a connected maritime landscape. In this episode, we talks with Senior Colonel Retired Zhou Bo from the Center for International Security and Strategy, Tsinghua University China, about U.S.-China relations, including military relations and the risk of incidents in the South China Sea.
Hello everyone, welcome to another episode of the From the Sea podcast series. This is Du Huang from the East Sea Institute, and today I have a very honorable pleasure to be sharing the platform with Senior Colonel Retired Zhou Bo from Tsinghua University. So, welcome.
Thank you.
Yeah, and we're here in the Ho Chi Minh City to attend the 15th South China Sea Conference. So yesterday you mentioned in your speech that there was a sentiment that, there wouldn't be any effective dialogue without respect, right? That was one of the sentiments that was...
I'm talking about a significant and effective dialogue between the Chinese and the U.S. military. So I'm not referring to China-ASEAN talks, because when it comes to China-U.S. military talks, the fact is we actually have for decades, been discussing about this issue ever since 1998. As a focal point is about security, which in Chinese is just one word, 安全, but this could have two different words in English. One is security, another is safety. So Americans would keep on sending aircraft and ships to come in a provocative manner, either in terms of freedom navigation or just the closing reconnaissance. So they ask for the safety of the crews and sailors and the safety of the aircraft and ships. But China would talk on the bigger strategic issue, that is China's national security, because we believe Americans' provocation is actually detrimental to China's security. We could never, agree on the two as different aspects of the same coin. So that is why we have been, talking past each other. And so right now we do not have any dialogue between we don't have a serious dialogues between the two sides after Nancy Pelosi's visit to Taiwan. So I'm wondering, first of all, how the dialogues could be resumed. But then even if after it is resumed, how could we behave in a different way? Because if we just do whatever we have been doing in the past, again, it's not leading anywhere.
Mm. But then I would say that in this past year alone, there have been some signs of resumed dialogue between, and we've seen high leaders visits as well between the U.S. and China. Are you optimistic about the chances of some of the regular exchange being reconnected?
Yes, some progress is already made, but in some other sectors, rather than direct military-to-military talk. Okay. So we are seeing, the leaders meeting each other, but it's not an official visit to the capital of the other side. It is more at international meetings, such as G20 in Bali and on such occasions. So this actually is not such a healthy thing, for the two largest economy in the world. And yes, some other talks, for example, at finance department, these things are unfolding. This is very good. Also, some senior American officials have come to visit China. I think probably Biden administration would like to have a kind of a stabilized relationship with China. Of course, China also have this kind of good wish. But the point is, Americans has been describing this relationship as one of competition, where China hopes that this is more a relationship of cooperation in spite of the elements of competition.
And so you see those interactions as a completely isolated area, and would you say that they will not have any spillover effect to the mill-to-mill dialogue?
I think the relationship in some other sectors are easier to manage because China and the United States are well-developed economies, being the largest economy and second-largest economy. So we have to have a lot of interactions, especially in economic field. But the military relationship is much more sensitive, We used to hope that this kind of relationship could actually serve as a ballast stone, you know, that can actually stabilize this often turbulent relationship. But it doesn't seem to be the case. Yeah. So we have to be realistic. But I think there is one common point between the Chinese and the US military, that is no one wants to see a conflict. Yeah. But the question is, how can you manage if you keep on sending aircraft, yeah, for closing reconnaissance and surveillance, including ships, and you don't want to a conflict? Then this is a kind of a contradictory, yeah, to the very purpose. So for us, our wish is very simple. You should reduce your number of reconnaissance and surveillance at least. Huh? The best thing, of course, is you do not come. Then, of course, there is no conflict, because we seldom, yeah, send aircraft. We seldom send ships to sail in the waters of continental USA. Yeah, so in this way, of course, we're not provocative. At the conference, you have heard American delegate talking about our frequent interception of American aircrafts or ships. That probably would be once every 2 or 3 days. So that is why I ask, why did we intercept? Because you came, yeah, so frequently. So our action is responsive.
And then you mentioned earlier that you assess that Biden administration, they want to somehow stabilize the relationship on the political, diplomatical level, right? I was wondering, because, you know, we saw a lot of different contrasting information on the news sometime. They said that, oh, this particular meeting, this particular trip was initiated by China, but then some other sources would say it was more initiated by the US. Do you have any insights on whom initiated such interaction in the past year, or was it like a collaborative effort?
I think recently we have seen a litany of senior American officials visiting China, right? So like the Secretary of Treasury, of Finance, So these people definitely are sent by President Biden, right, with agreement of the Chinese government. So right now, I don't believe people from both sides have very high expectations. So even if we can make small progress, that is good enough. Mm-hmm. So probably we can build on the small progresses mm-hmm. to make sure that at least, yeah, we're not derailed from the track.
Okay. And I remember back in May, I think it was May 2022, when Secretary of State Antony Blinken made the statement about the new approach to China from the Biden administration, and in which he mentions, I think there were five potential areas of cooperation between the US and China, among which include climate change and food, energy, and North Korean issues, so on and so forth. So apart from some of the diplomatic engagement we've seen this past year, do you see any progress on actual cooperation in some of those areas?
Well, actually, I think what he said is already a progress from what was said by officials of the Trump administration. During Trump administration, you almost hear nothing except cooperation on climate change. Some people might also say sometimes about the need to cooperate on non-proliferation, but that's almost all, yeah? But at least Secretary Blinken was talking about five areas, yeah? So this is inevitable, because the American policy toward China is not driven by rationality, but rather by a kind of a mixed thing. And so what is a mixed thing? I think it is driven by narcissism. And then a kind of despair, because the narcissism is dashed. And, you know, and it's also driven by kind of worry or angst about America's relative decline. And then they start to look for enemies. Yeah. So putting all this together, yeah, they just see China a bit like Soviet Union in the past. But they are worried in that because these two largest economy are so integrated and so it's difficult for them to describe China as an enemy. So they treat China as a primary competitor. And they adopted a policy of decoupling. Mm-hmm. But now they would actually use another de-risking, which was borrowed from, Ursula von der Leyen, the EU chairman. Because I actually believe talking from decoupling to de-risking is actually a progress. Why? Because decoupling would not work. So they realize it is impossible to decouple. So now they talk about de-risk. Again, of course, there is a question of what does de-risking mean? Yeah, so I probably believe that even they themselves would find it very difficult to explain. Mm-hmm. So in which areas they want to de-risk, for example, in high-tech areas, then the government officials want to do that, you know, for example, on chips and so on and so forth. But all the top American chip manufacturers would say, you know, that if you do that, then we'll lose at least one third of our production, because China is such a huge market. So Americans' current strategy of having a high fence, small yard is also failing.
So from your point of view, the change in terms of language is already some kind of progress.
Yeah.
Right? But has there been any like actual progress in terms of substantial cooperation? For example, with climate change, we saw John Kerry, especially involving climate change, visiting China in July. Has there been anything concrete that come out of that?
I think the fact that more senior American officials are coming to China is a good sign. Okay. And these can be taken as a kind of a progress. Yeah. On climate change, I'm most happy to see John Kerry coming to China, because this is really about everybody. And China and the United States have to take the lead, to be the two largest emitter. And this has everything to do with every country's. Mm-hmm. So if he comes, would like to talk on this kind of issue, and China would like to talk to him, this would be very good. You see, the point is, because China-US relationship is so important, actually it matters for everybody. So the fact that people see these two giants talking to each other is a relief for everybody, right?
Just a little bit more on climate change. So one of the narratives that I saw a lot from, you know, some of the academia or some of the media pundit about China being a, one of the biggest emitters of carbon emissions, but still labeling itself as a developing country to reduce the levels of duty. What is your assessment on that kind of narrative?
That was kind of narrative in the past, I think probably 10 years ago. Mm. So the Chinese government is definitely attaching great importance to resolve this problem. And our capability in moving in this direction is also getting stronger. When a country becomes more developed, you certainly have more resources and the means to do what you want. So domestically speaking, you would find the Chinese air much more clean now. And the President Xi Jinping has made it quite clear. We needed to have, green mountain and green water. And this actually would be golden mountain and a golden river, something like that. So in China, everybody is highly, sensitive to environmental issue now. So I think we are, this kind of understanding about environment itself is a huge, huge progress. The problem for all developing countries is, of course, all developing countries want to develop, but the point is they seem to be going, as always, a kind of vicious cycle of pollution first, before management, right? So China is such a large country with such a large population. If China can succeed, in the managing our environment, I think China can really, tell us a lot to the developing countries, how we can actually do things in a better way. And China really can make some contributions. For example, China is the strongest nation on solar power. So this kind of solar power, of course, would be a huge substitute for coal, for gas and oil, right? So this is China's contribution, because China in this field is next to none.
And maybe deviating from that, but still within the U.S.-China dynamic, I think yesterday you were talking about how it is very difficult for U.S. and China to calm down from the current tensions. And maybe your predictions is the only way for the situation to cool down is for crisis to happen. Or do you see that scenario happening?
My assessment is somewhat pessimistic. But I actually having discussed it with an American scholar, yeah, he kind of agreed with me, because this is just a simple mathematic issue. Yeah, if they keep sending aircraft and ships to come, and the PLA is getting stronger, and the stronger PLA would become less tolerant with this kind of issues that China believe are sovereignty issues. You know, on sovereignty issue, no countries want to give up. Yeah. So therefore, this kind of antagonism will simply grow. And it's very difficult for Americans to back down, because they have been doing this, yeah, for decades. But it does not mean that because they have been doing this for decades, therefore, they're right in so doing, because they have not ratified Hong Clause, which is often quote as a kind of justification for what they have been doing. My question for them is very simple. Yeah, if Hong Clause is so good, why don't you ratify it? Yeah, if it is not good, then why would you challenge others in the name of it, right? So Americans' behavior is just like someone, you know, walking the street and pointing to a club to say, okay, some club members of this club are not observing the rules of the club, right? But for you to talk like that, you have to join the club yourself. You're outside of the club, and how can you, you know, condemn club members? This is just like that. And the point is, the United States is not only challenging China. Actually, in 2022, they have challenged the 22 so-called excessive maritime claims of 15 countries. So many countries are challenging. I think probably Vietnam is also challenging in one way or another. Certainly they have challenged in India or Malaysia. So we are not the only one, but probably was the only one that would respond militarily, because China's military is strong. That's the difference. Mm.
So if a crisis happens, would you predict that it would be in the South China Sea?
I think mostly it will be in the South China Sea, because that is where, you know, they keep on sending ships and aircrafts to come. Normally, when the Americans sell the ships, they are cautious when they think about China's territorial sea. So normally it would happen in the exclusive economic zone, yeah, or in the space above the exclusive economic zone. But the Chinese, of course, would not accept this. Therefore, it invites a question of so-called professionalism. Again, it's a difficult term to explain. Nobody knows, you know, what it would stand for, except that we call for good airmanship and seamanship.
But then also, between the U.S. and China, there are a lot of mechanisms, such as COREG, or some of the code of conduct. And back in the Cold War, the U.S. and the Soviet Union also signed with each other some sort of code of conduct to avoid collisions on the ground, right? So would you say that these mechanisms would somehow reduce the chance for miscalculations on the ground?
They are certainly helpful. They are certainly useful. But they would not be able to resolve the problem. And there are actually not many, you know, agreements between China and the U.S. In this regard. In 2014, we have a code of conduct for our planned encounter at sea. That is agreed, you know, among, I think it is the 21 navies in the Western Pacific, yeah, including China, United States, and of course Vietnam, all these countries involved. So we have another rule of behavior that is between Chinese and American military, which is very much a copy of Q's. So they're not very different. For example, in both agreements, there are no indications as to when two aircraft meet each other, or when two ships meet one another, what is the safe distance? Because this cannot be written clearly as to, for example, how many meters we have to, you know, keep a distance from each other. Because you can't do that, because the size of the ship might be different. The speed of the ships are also different. And then we could have wind, right? And then we could have visibility. All these factors that are identified as seven major factors in Q's would affect, you know, this kind of a professional, you know, encounter. So that is why there's a kind of learning, say, in a very general manner about good airmanship or good seamanship. Yeah. And when there is a problem, I would accuse you of being unprofessional, failing to observe good airmanship and seamanship.
So in the South China Sea, there has been some sort of near collisions in the past between the US and China, you know, impeccable back in the day, 2009, right? But then recently I've seen that with some of the close encounters, the media have been very quick in, you know, releasing footages, putting out videos and photos. Would you say that maybe if there is no clear definitions of professionalism, but do you think those sort of, you know, visual footage or visual recording, do they help clarify what professionalism means?
There are not only near collisions. There was a deadly collision in 2001, yeah? And then there are a lot of near collisions. They release videos, and we also release videos. The question is from which angle you are actually making the video,
So they can be easily
yeah?
distorted.
I think, yeah, this at least is not so black and white, yeah? So that is Chinese view. To resolve the problem, the fundamental issue is that we don't believe, your closing reconnaissance surveillance, yeah, is good for the region, and it's essentially provocative, yeah. And Americans would just say, "I'll still come. When I come to do something harmful to you, you must make sure that I'm safe." How can any other countries agree, yeah, to this kind of allegation? It is impossible.
This is the end of this episode. Stay tuned for the second part of our discussion with Senior Colonel Retired Zhou Bo, which will be released on Google Podcast, Spotify, and Apple Podcast, as well as Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter. Thank you for listening.
The second show.